Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, August 23, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss national security, cybersecurity, and the new book by former CIA and NSA Director General Michael Hayden. The title of that book is Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. It's a best-selling book available on Amazon and at bookstores everywhere. I am, by the way, Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to proceed today with an interview format. We're joined by repeat teleforum guest, Professor Jamil N. Jaffer. He's adjunct professor and director of the Homeland and National Security Law Program. He's going to be conducting an interview of General Michael Hayden. And as always, however, we'll be getting to the audience for questions, so please do be thinking of those questions from when we get to that portion of the program. With that, for introductions and the rest of the program, Professor Jaffer, the floor is yours.
Well, thanks, Dean, and thanks to the Federal Society for hosting this call, and thanks most importantly to General Michael Hayden for joining us today. It's a real treat to have him here, and I thought I'd give you all a little introduction to General Hayden, and then we'd start talking about the primary topic of our conversation today, which is cyber warfare in the modern era. So, General
Thank
Michael
you.
Hayden.
Thank you, Jamil. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. So Michael Hayden graduated from Duquesne University with a bachelor's degree in 1967 and a master's degree in modern American history in 1969. He did his postgraduate work at the Defense Intelligence School, hosted by DIA, and he currently serves as a distinguished visiting professor at George Mason University, where I also serve at the Antonin Scalia School of Law. Most importantly, though, General Michael Hayden served his country with distinction and honor in the United States Air Force. And served as both director of the National Security Agency, as the first principal deputy director of national intelligence, and finished his career in the government as director of the Central Intelligence Agency. And we're talking today with General Hayden about his book, as Dean mentioned, Playing to the Edge. General Hayden, great book, really interesting, great stories in this book. But some, in particular, most interesting to me was the stories you told in Chapter 8 about what you call life in the cyber domain between 1996 and 2010, and your work first starting out the Air Intelligence Agency in San Antonio, Texas. How did you end up at AIA in San Antonio, and what was your experience when you arrived there?
Sure. Well, first of all, Jamil, thanks again for the opportunity. Second, thanks for focusing on Chapter 8. You know, the book came out about 6 months ago. I've been making the rounds, talking to various groups, and they always end in Q&A, and I'm quite happy to sit there and take all comers like we will do this afternoon. Jamil, Chapter 8 is the least remarked chapter in the book. And frankly, I was quite proud, pleased anyway, that I was able to get as much as I was able to get into Chapter 8 through NSA and CIA classification review. I actually think there's a lot of new stuff in there. So to begin at the beginning, as your question suggests, I kind of get my first dipping in the cyber domain when I get picked to be the commander of what the Air Force then called the Air Intelligence Agency in San Antonio, Texas. I had been the J-2, the Chief of Intelligence for all U.S. forces in Korea. And if you recall the timing, 93, 94, 95, the war was the war in Bosnia and Croatia. And so I was incredibly focused on a war that I actually suggest in the book was medieval in its origins and medieval in its conduct. And then I get reassigned after 2.5 years in Europe to Texas to take over this agency, which frankly, Jamil, was actually on the cutting edge of American, not just even American military, but American thinking about cyber. And I mentioned an anecdote in the book that is a bit apocryphal, but is a good summary of my orientation, which was, General, glad you're here. Now sit down, take out a clean sheet of paper and a number 2 pencil, and write this down. Land, sea, air, space, cyber. It's a domain. It's a place. It's a location where the nation now expects us to defend it. And for me, Jamil, that was an epiphany. I almost said, well, why didn't you say so? Oh, that other stuff was more complicated. I get it. Once you tell an American GI it's a domain, a lot of things kick in, and thus begins my journey in the cyber domain.
So this was something you figured out and the folks at AIA figured out back in 1997. But you mentioned in your book, you know, that when Deputy Defense Secretary Bill Lynn described peace and foreign affairs, you know, over a decade later in 2010, described cyberspace as a domain, it was controversial. And in fact, he got some pushback from within the government with Jane Hall-Lutz at DHS. Tell us about that.
Yeah, no, it's really a fact. Again, back to the chapter that kind of outlines this. And as you suggest, Jamil, it took a decade, but frankly, given all the change, that's the speed of light for any government, but particularly the American government. And it is true that Air Intelligence Agency view of this gradually became American military doctrine. And then Deputy Secretary Lynn, in an incredibly seminal article in Foreign Affairs, lays that out as the way the Department of Defense thinks about this. Land, sea, air, space, cyber. It's a domain. We're going to go fight and defend there, just like you expect us to go fight and defend in all the other domains. And I do suggest in the book that was not an incredibly coordinated intra-agency document that Secretary Lynn signed and sent to New York for Foreign Affairs to publish. So as soon as it gets out of the gate, Jamil, you get an awful lot of pushback, and particularly from the Department of Homeland Security. But and there was some sandpapering of the edges and so on. But fundamentally, I, the Air Force, the Department of Defense, thinks as cyber as a domain. And let me give you the actual absolutely compelling point, Jamil. If it's a domain, you need a command. We got a command, cyber command. Why? Because it's a domain of warfare. We're going to go operate there.
Yeah, well, no doubt. And so let's rewind back to 97. So you're there at AIA and right at the cutting edge, and people are talking, you know, your staff and you were talking about this as a domain. You're starting to build capabilities. You're briefing, you know, the chief of staff of the Air Force about this
right.
New technologies. And you actually sort of showed some examples about what you could do. And tell some of those examples.
Yeah.
And, you know, you mentioned that there's a lot of new in this chapter, and some of that is new, but what's really new comes later, and we'll get to that. But tell us about those early examples of what we could do, even back in the late 90s.
Sure. So we're thinking big thoughts. And by the way, Jamil, I in the book, and I need to do this afternoon, all right, I relied a lot on the thinking of one of my predecessors, not just at AIA, but at NSA, retired Air Force Lieutenant General Ken Minahan, who did an awful lot of the groundbreaking conceptual work on this. So now I go into San Antonio, where the Air Intelligence Agency is headquartered. We're thinking big thoughts, and then we're trying to develop capability. And, you know, I have a running analogy in the chapter, Jamil, that this is an awful lot like Billy Mitchell in the 1930s, who thought really big thoughts about air power. But then again, you had to go build aircraft that were capable of carrying out those big thoughts. And frankly, that turned out to be very hard to do. Well, that was the way it was in the cyber domain, too. So we had developed a few tools, and I got the permission of the chief of staff of the Air Force to actually demonstrate some of these tools at what's called a Corona Top. Corona as in a group of stars. Corona Top is the gathering of Air Force 3 and 4 stars. This was in Scott Air Force Base in southern Illinois. The chief gave me more than 2 hours on the agenda, which is like an unprecedented amount of time for this topic, but he wanted to introduce his leadership to what we could do. And we actually wired things. I mean, this wasn't Memorex. This was live. We were actually conducting cyber operations in front of the gathered 3 and 4 stars. And talk about working without a net, Jamil. I mean, you know, all this had to work. And as often happens in these kinds of events, a thunderstorm came rolling through San Antonio about 20 minutes before we were to go live in Illinois. all the power on Security Hill, where my headquarters was located, went out. And frankly, we got power back up just in time to carry out the demonstrations, all of which succeeded. And so, you know, another brick, putting it down on the wall there of building cyber awareness and later cyber capability.
Terrific. And you mentioned that, you know, in this exercise, you're actually able to demonstrate the ability to disable remotely workstations, spoof radar scopes, so really interesting sort of technical capabilities back in the 90s. So then we continue to think about this, and, you know, the process evolves, the things that you started with your team there and building on Ken Minahan's work. We move into the 2000s and Secretary Lin puts a statement out, and of course, because cyberspace is now a domain, we're going to want to dominate it. And so we have information dominance, concepts of information dominance and leveraging dominance. And we start to have this concept called active defense. And so tell us a little about active defense and what that means, what that meant in that era, to the
sure.
folks. I know by that time you had left the government, but how does Secretary Lin describe active defense and how do you think about it?
Well, I mean, it's really a reflection, Jamil, of the fact that these were really big concepts and they were fuzzy along the edges. I mean, we're breaking incredibly new ground here. You know, what of our traditional thinking in physical space can you automatically or justifiably transfer into your thinking in cyberspace? And let me just give you one really quick example. Deterrence theory, as we know it to be in physical space, breaks down, doesn't easily transfer into cyberspace. So, I mean, there's a whole bunch of new thinking going on while in parallel, we are trying to develop real capacity. One of the great issues we have was how to bin what it was we were doing. I mean, how to describe. I mean, I could show it to you technologically. I could give you some operational importance for it, Jamil. But in a democracy like ours, I have to tell you what it is by category. Is that an intelligence activity, or is that a traditional military activity? You and I know the code. Is it a Title 50 activity or a Title 10 activity, which perhaps your listeners aren't that familiar with, but it's a big deal because that determines what authorities under which you operate, what laws apply, what congressional committees have oversight, and where you get your money. And so we had these great challenges. So we get to this one activity called cyber defense. No one argues that it's legitimate cyber defense to actually, patch your firewall or to have good hygiene or to have complex passwords. Yeah, that's all good. Now, what of your activity beyond your own firewall that you undertake to protect your network, what of that activity can you legitimately categorize as cyber defense? Because the problem, Jamil, is it doesn't look like cyber defense to the other guy. You're beyond your firewall. You're in his backyard, and you're doing stuff to his network. And so where do you draw the line? And I have to freely admit, Jamil, that's still a point of debate. Now, in Secretary Lin's article, he's got a wonderful, wonderful description of this issue. And he says, what we're talking about in the cyber domain is having the Department of Defense being sentry, sensor, and sharpshooter. Wonderful alliteration. And a sentence that I say in the book probably would have raised concerns in every other capital on earth. What do the Americans mean when they say they're going to develop sensor, sentry, and sharpshooter? And again, it's watch this space, Jamil. The debate goes on.
So this is great. So, you know, as we talk, General, about these questions, Title 10 versus Title 50, and what authorities do you operate under, and what congressional committee do you report to, and where do you get your budget from, and is this a covert action? Is it traditional military activity? Is it done under command authority from the Secretary of Defense, from the President to the Secretary of Defense? And presumably your lawyers were heavily involved in these conversations, both as you began these activities at AIA, moved to NSA, built up the capability. And we'll talk a little bit more about how you built that capability with JFCCNW and the NTOC. But I'm sure your lawyers were there alongside you the whole way. What role did the lawyers play, and what can you tell us about the advice they gave and the challenges you faced dealing with the legal questions at play here? Because presumably this question of authorities, transcends the question of capabilities. So you have the capability, but then when you go to deliver it, it's a question of authorities. And how did that play out?
So first of all, Jamil, you and the listeners need to understand that lawyers are intensely integrated into operations at the National Security Agency. Now, look, I know post-Snowden, there are a lot of national debates about whether or not NSA is lawless or not. It is not lawless. We can have an honest discussion as to where the lines in the law ought to be. I got that. All right, but NSA is not lawless. NSA plays within the lines, and you need your lawyers there to give you crisp definition as to where the lines are. Let me give you an incredibly fundamental question here, Jamil. So I've got an adversary network. Let's just assume for purposes of argument, we all agree it's a legitimate foreign intelligence target. It meets all the requirements of American law and policy. And I penetrate that network in order to steal information. I just want to know what's going on in there. I want to know what's in the files. I want to know what they're saying back and forth. And carrying out my intelligence function, my espionage responsibility, I grab stuff and I bring it home. That is fully within the authority of the National Security Agency. That's what it's been doing since 1952 when Harry Truman started it. It's just a new technology to do the old job. But you know, Jamil, once you're in that network, you can do a lot of other stuff. You just don't have to copy somebody else's homework. You could destroy someone else's homework. Or you could manipulate and change someone else's homework. Or you can make the network on which that homework resides go away. None of those things I just listed, Jamil, none of those things are within the authorities of the National Security Agency. And what's really interesting about this is that once you've penetrated the network, which is a really difficult task, and you live on it undetected, and you pull information from it in large quantities while still remaining undetected, changing data, destroying data, that's easy. That's just a flip of a switch. But there are no authorities at NSA to do it. And therefore NSA didn't do it, hasn't done it, and won't do it. You actually had to create another construct, another entity. The one you referred to before goes by the horrible acronym JFCCNW, Joint Functional Component Command Net Warfare, which then later became Cyber Command. Those institutions get created to take advantage of what NSA was already able to do but could not legally carry out. So talk about a legal thicket, Jamil, every step of the way.
Yeah, and I remember we used to have these early morning, every Tuesday and Thursday, battlefield update assessments where the lawyers would sit around and the operational folks would come in and brief us on NW activities and sort of get a lawyer check off from around the intelligence community and
yep.
At the time it was the Justice Department. And it was amazing. And, people really, you're right to say that, people don't quite understand how involved the lawyers are and how involved, when it comes to intelligence question activities, how involved the courts are. They see the results that the FISA court endorses, 99% of the things. But the reality is there's a tremendous and painful, I think, for the intelligence community process to go through before anything is ever even submitted to the court, much less approved. And you live that. And on the operational side, the same is true. There are constant checks and balances in place with the lawyers constantly reviewing these things, and it's a real challenge. But going back to this Title 10, Title 50 issue, so you mentioned that you all created a structure under STRATCOM. You mentioned this in your book, Playing to the Edge, in the chapter Life in the Cyber Domain. You mentioned that under STRATCOM, you created this Joint Functional Component Command for Network Warfare, and the role of that entity was to, using Title 10 authorities, actually conduct both what you call CNA, computer network attack,
right,
and I think play a role in at least informing what you call CND, computer network defense. But all of that was built on the structure of CNE, NSA's traditional activity, computer network exploitation, getting in there and essentially stealing secrets. How did all that go together, and how did it work when you were dual-hatted as director of NSA? So your job was intelligence question on one hand, but then dual-hatted as a sort of, you know, a component commander with an offensive mission for computer network attack. How did that dual-hatting work, and how did you sort the two sides out?
Yeah, that's a very well-structured explanation, Jamil. My congratulations. So here's the challenge, and it's repeating a little bit of what I said earlier, but perhaps in a slightly different way. And so you talked about Title 10, Title 50. For your listeners, Title 50 has to do with espionage, intelligence. Title 10, traditional military activities. So in physical space, you need to conduct reconnaissance before you conduct an operational act. Well, I mean, if you're smart, you need to. Otherwise, your operational act is likely not to be successful. And so in physical space, Jamil, it's always been reconnaissance first, the attack second, to oversimplify. And in physical space, the reconnaissance didn't just come first. It almost always was the operationally and technologically less sophisticated task. Finding Soviet ICBMs in the 1970s was hard work, not nearly as hard as stopping them. I use an example in the book that Jeb Stuart, trying to fix the Army of the Potomac and give its location to Robert E. Lee, was very demanding work, but not nearly as hard as Lee trying to defeat the Army of the Potomac. So physical space, recce first, recce almost always easier. Cyberspace, back to Title 10, Title 50. Recce first, of course, you've got to know the network. But unlike physical space, in cyberspace, Jamil, the attack, as I suggested earlier, the attack is actually a lesser included case of the espionage you've already achieved. Then back to the structure you outlined, how then do we take advantage of that reality that the intel guys have already given you everything you need to do the other tasks while still respecting the very appropriate division in U.S. law between military activities and espionage activities? And the answer we came up with is that the director of NSA is out there doing what you appropriately describe as CNE, computer network exploitation, the espionage stuff. He also wears another hat in a separate chain of command, and this one came through U.S. Strategic Command, whereby he could then use that combatant commander's authority on order to direct the forces under his command, which have already done the espionage, to do the additional tasks if that was lawfully ordered. And so that was the creation. That's why right now Cyber Command is out at Fort Meade. That's why the commander of Cyber Command is still also the director of the National Security Agency. Because what you've got here, Jamil, to kind of revisit it one last time, at the operation and technological level, the activities are indistinguishable. At the legal, statutory, and funding level, however, they are very distinguished. And what we created is a way to balance those two compelling realities.
Terrific. And for the audience, we're talking to General Michael Hayden, the former director of the NSA and the CIA, about his book, Plane to the Edge, Life in the Cyber Domain. And we're talking about some of the both practical and the policy and the legal issues associated with operating in the cyber domain in this chapter of his book called Plane to the Edge. So General Hayden, you know, to come back to this issue you were just talking about, of the dual hatting, you know, there's been a debate out there in public recently within the Obama administration about whether we ought to separate the commander of U.S. Cyber Command and the director of NSA. One of the advantages that I always saw, and I think that you had advocated for, and tell me if I could be too mistaken about that, but tell me if this is true, was that the dual hatting allowed one individual to make that judgment about the intelligence gain loss. Because what's unique and interesting about, as you just pointed out, about, you know, you conducting computer network attack is because you're using an intelligence access, oftentimes you'll lose that intelligence access once you conduct the activity, the offensive activity, because now you've made the enemy aware that you're in their network and you're now doing something to the extent that the activity becomes known. And so If that's the case, is it beneficial to have that individual dual hatted so you can make that judgment call? And doesn't separating that out cause sort of a potential challenge, or is it better to separate the two?
No, great question. And frankly, my view changes over time, not because I'm changing my mind, Jamil, but because the factors on which the decision has to be based are changing. And so back in the day, which I just described for you, Joint Functional Component Command, net warfare, the early days of cyber command, there is only one answer. And that answer is you dual hat the commander and the director, and you keep both institutions at Fort Meade and put as much connective tissue between the two as you possibly can. That does ease what we call the equities burden. Jamil, that's what you just described. Do you want to continue to collect intelligence from that network, or do you want to deny that network to your adversary? And oh, by the way, that's not a new problem with the cyber domain. Espionage, digital espionage, electronic surveillance has had that problem since 1952 and before. I mean, their history is filled with examples of a commander having to decide, use the information and lose the access, or the reverse. So it's not a new problem, but I agree with you. Having the dual hatting situation made the resolution perhaps less contentious than it would otherwise be. But over time, Jamil, over time, we were going to have to build up Cyber Command as its own entity, because fundamentally it has a different mission than NSA does. And the longer they were together, frankly, the more you might see NSA turn away from its traditional intelligence mission, which is, after all, Jamil, to learn, and more into a combat support mission for Cyber Command, whose primary purpose was simply get me access. And although those things overlap a lot, sometimes they are very, very different things. And so over time, I think we all knew that we're moving in the direction where the two, NSA and Cyber Command, as Cyber Command became more mature, the more mature it became, the stronger the argument becomes to separate the two. Now, some have argued you should have separated them in the first place, that was not the way to arrange this because, frankly, it gives one man too much power. Frankly, Mike Rogers, the current director of NSA, current commander of Cyber Command, I think we ought to separate the jobs, Jamil, not because Mike Rogers got too much power. I think we need to separate the jobs because Mike Rogers got too much work. And now the demands of these two jobs are such that you can no longer continue the dual hatting relationship. So this is a very natural resolution where the solution that was correct 3, 5, and 7 years ago is not the solution that's going to be correct 3, 5, or 7 years from now.
Well, that makes sense. So I've thought a lot about this, and I think it's interesting the way you describe it and the evolution, the need to account for the fact that there's more work going on, and that you need to build these institutions in their own way. And so that does make a lot of sense to me. I want to mention to the audience that we are going to be taking questions a little bit later on, so please do be thinking about your questions for General Hayden. We'll probably do another 5-10 minutes of the back and forth between me and General Hayden, then we'll turn over to the audience for your questions. So, General Hayden, you know, one of the things you mentioned was, you know, there is a lot of new in your book, and one of the things I was actually, when I was reading your book, I was interested to see this discussion of JSCCW and some of its actual activities. I mean, you mentioned a particular directive that you were given, an execute order that was provided to the agency, to deal with adversary you see internet, Al-Qaeda's use of the internet. Tell us about that CAWI XOR, as it was called.
Yeah, what an ugly acronym, CAWI, CAUI, Countering Adversary Use of the Internet. And by the way, isn't that a current issue with regard to what ISIS is doing now? So we had this standing operations order, which really isn't authority to go do anything specific right now. It is a broad operational concept where you would develop capabilities and would then recommend to the appropriate decision-making bodies actions to counter adversary use of the Internet. And the story I tell, Jamil, is that in one of the run-ups to a 9/11 anniversary, the proposal was made to make it very difficult for a videotape of Osama bin Laden to appear on global media through the Internet. And that decision was debated, and it was decided to go forward and go ahead and unleash our capabilities to suppress the video, in essence, to frustrate al-Qaeda's propaganda aim, and maybe just to kind of demonstrate that we can go do this. You know, this is not a free fire zone for you guys. We actually have some tools up here. So that was approved at the deputy's level. The specific order was given, and the appropriate offices at Fort Meade carried out the attack, and it was, frankly, very, very successful. There was collateral damage to the attack, though, Jamil. You know, one of the websites that could have been used for the bin Laden video was a particularly vile jihadist website that was actually controlled by a friend. It was their honeypot to pull people in. Back to your earlier question, Jamil, do I deny my adversary use of it, or should I just look at it to learn about my adversary? That's what this was about. And the decision was made in this case, we're going to take the site down. We did. We frustrated al-Qaeda's efforts to get the video out, but then we just kept the site down for an inordinate period of time, which then began to complicate our relationship with our ally, who was getting very, very angry at what he was confident a friend was doing to his watering hole, so to speak. It became very contentious, and by this time I'm over at the Central Intelligence Agency living with the consequences of the impact of this technically and technologically successful cyber attack, but was now carrying an incredible geopolitical weight as collateral damage to it. I was very angry. I wanted the attack to stop, to allow the site to be rebuilt that our ally, our friend, wanted to do. It became a very contentious issue within the interagency. And I, who was the first commander of JFCCNW and Net Warfare, I actually took a very strong view. And I actually said, and it's recorded in the book, and I was so angry, I went to Steve Hadley and said, Steve, if anybody got any future ideas about a cyber attack, don't bother calling a meeting. CIA is going to mail its answer in. The answer is no, until you can assure me we've got a greater grip on fine-tuning not just the attack, but its effects and when we should stop these kinds of actions. So it's, as I said, first time in prime time that story's been out, and it's in the book, fairly unremarked, Jamil. I try to tell the story in the book without being judgmental about it towards anyone. This is, you know, one of those interagency knife fights that occasionally pops up, and you don't have to dislike or condemn an opponent in those kinds of things. I tell the story simply to show that even after you've mastered some technological aspects of an attack, making war in this domain is so new and so different that a whole host of other questions then raise their head.
Yeah, and I, you know, again, for the audience, I don't think you can quite capture how interesting this you know, this two pages 148 and 149 of Plane to the Edge, General Hayden's book in the chapter Life in the Cyber Domain is, in part because, you know, I was living these events at the Justice Department, you were living them at CIA, you know, folks were living in an NSA, and this was a hot and heavy situation, and a very challenging one involving, as you point out, new authority being employed in a unique construct at a very tense time for the nation. You know, increasing terrorist threats. We were concerned, and we had partners involved, and it's a very interesting story. And you're right, one that's been unfocused on, but one that really tells a lot about what was going on in the government at the time, and you know, a lot of successful efforts that we had, you know, in this space around that time frame that stories have not yet been told and one day may be told.
Jamil, there's an epilogue to this. You know,
yeah.
When we got at CIA in the interagency after action, you know, as I said, we were kind of angry. And we said, so what is it everyone thought they approved? All right, because, again, our complaint was it didn't stop even after we'd achieved the near-term objective. And so we did our kind of informal forensics on, so what did the people at the deputies committee agree this was going to do for how long? And this is probably a little bit of hyperbole here, Jamil, but not a whole lot. We talked to the people in the room, and it was clear to us it was really hard to find two people who actually agreed that they had approved the same thing. All right? What I'm trying to suggest to you is, again, back to the newness of this and the heavy technological flavor of this, when you're there talking to the deputy secretaries of this and that, and you're explaining this, you think you're saying something that's very clear. It's just that they aren't hearing something that's very clear. And so that forensic view as to how do we get to this point was very revealing in the burden that's put on people who would recommend such action to make sure the policymakers whose approval they are seeking really understand what it is they're asking for.
Absolutely. You know, it's critical that when you're in these situations, and, you know, there are oftentimes questions of classification and explanation. And the two things are very different, right? One is, does the person have access to the information? And two, do they understand the information they're being given in order to make the policy decision? And you're right, it's incumbent upon everyone involved in these decisions to ensure that everyone has full information and they know what they're deciding and that everyone's sort of signing off on the same thing. And, you know, these tensions do happen. And I think it'll be interesting when more of these stories are told, you know, I think the nation will really understand what a new and unique and yet successful capability that we've built within, you know, beginning at AIA, building up to JSCCNW, now U.S. Cyber Command, and how important that capability is to the nation and what a value it's demonstrated. I think there's really not yet a full appreciation of that, and maybe one day when these stories are told and they're declassified as part of them were in your book, I think it'll be very interesting.
Well, and another point, Jamil, is that, you know, these are hard questions, and we weren't stupid, we were serious, but the questions are hard. And I think the American people need to understand that people in good conscience were struggling with new concepts and new capabilities and, frankly, a new environment to do something that was consistent with American laws and values.
Yeah, I do think what's interesting, too, is, you know, in the past, you know, you've described the important consistency in counterterrorism policy between the Bush administration and the Obama administration. And even though there have been differences in the way things have been executed and the scope of the operations, what has been true is a very consistent, fairly strong use of American power to go after the adversary where they live and fight and have been successful in keeping the threat away from, at least in large part, from the United States. And so it's also interesting to see a parallel thing going on in cyberspace where you describe a very consistent theme from Ken Minahan to you to Keith Alexander over a course of over almost 20 years in terms of being advocates for cyber. And while there may have been differences amongst all of you in how you implemented it and how things played out in any given circumstance, there's a consistent, proactive view on both collection of intelligence and the notion of cyberspace as a domain and one that the U.S. must be successful and lead in.
No, that's exactly right. And oh, by the way, Jamil, you and I think what you just said is intuitively obvious. It's not intuitively obvious to all of our countrymen, because there's an aspect of that chapter where I actually take on the argument by many, and you know, serious people who think all the things you and I have been talking about now for 35 minutes reflects the United States' unnecessary militarization of what should have been a digital global commons, and that our move into this space militarized cyberspace in a way that for which we should take fundamental responsibility and, from their point of view, blame and guilt. And so, yeah, you and I thought that was just a natural thing, but not everyone thinks that.
Well, and on that note, it seems like it's a perfectly good time to see if the audience has some questions. So just a reminder, folks, we are discussing today the book Playing to the Edge with General Michael Hayden, the former director of CIA and NSA. We focused a lot on his chapter about Life in the Cyber Domain. We're definitely open to talking about more parts of the book. And so, Dean, are there questions from the audience?
Well, let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our guest, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got lots of people on the line, but we've got about 20 minutes for questions. We begin with three today, so let's take our first call.
You have.
Thank you, gentlemen, for those comments. My name is Chris. I want to ask about a topic that we haven't directly, addressed thus far, and relate it to cyber capabilities. And that is the Iran deal into which the U.S. Entered. And my first question is whether each of you, in particular General Hayden, believe that it's in the U.S.'s best interest that we entered into that deal. And as relating to the more specific to today's topic, the extent to which your opinion is based on some, you know, capabilities that that we have or may have in the future for ascertaining just how far the Iranians have gone with respect to developing delivery systems and fissionable, you know, materials into bombs.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. So there's actually a separate chapter in the book on Iran. I outlined that this was a tough intel target and an even more difficult policy question. I marshaled some arguments as to why I am uncomfortable with aspects of this deal. But then, I end the chapter by saying something along the lines of, I don't think we'd have bought this package, referring to the Bush administration. But then again, it wasn't like we had a better idea. And that's how I end the Iran discussion. So I feel free to be critical, but I also try to be understanding that this was the devil's own problem. And we met on this routinely, informally, in Steve Hadley's office. No minutes, no notes, no seconds. Hadley, the vice president, chairman, SecDef, SecState, me, and the director of national intelligence, and just trying to work our way forward. And, you know, we didn't come up with any secret sauce or magic elixir to solve the Iranian movement towards towards a nuclear capability. I should tell you, Chris, that my biggest heartburn with the deal, in addition to enabling Iran to go do a bunch of other stuff and getting them out of the penalty box and so on, is what we were able to achieve. I mean, look, if the deal works, they don't cheat, we enforce it. If the deal works, we will have an Iran in 10 to 12 years that is an industrial strength nuclear power, never more than a few weeks away from enough fissile material for a nuclear weapon. And that's a successful deal. And so, again, my great concern with it. Let me just add one additional thought. You know, the Iranians think they know who conducted the Stuxnet attack against them. I don't comment on it. It's irresponsible of somebody of my background to even speculate it, but they think we did it. And the Iranians have really come after us with cyber attacks against American banks, against Saudi Aramco, and then against the Sands casino system, simply because the owner of that system was quite vocal in his anti-Iranian views. So they've shown cyber capabilities to hit the American homeland.
Thank you, sir. If I might follow up.
Sure.
Given what you noted just now, do you have a sense of you know, what animated the administration's entry into the deal? I know you said that, well, even the administration prior was not able to sort of keep Iran in a box from which it might otherwise spring an attack. But it, for many of us, and I'm not involved in the defense field anymore, so, you know, I'm not as close to these issues. But looking at the deal, I just don't see the pony in it. It seems to embolden more bad behavior. And for those of us who have studied these sorts of things at some length, it seems that we're going to get a worse result than to have kept to our knitting, so to speak.
So, Chris, let me begin by saying I agree with you. But now let me take the opposite case. Let me make the best case for the administration. And here, I think simply they were playing for what they believe to be the long game. And although, you know, I'm not reading anybody's memos and no one's giving me quiet private interviews over there, I think the macro approach they had was that they wanted to change the structure of the American presence in the Middle East. They wanted to get us off the Sunni squad in the Sunni versus Shia dispute there and get us up above that conflict, rather than playing for one side or the other, that we would be the offshore balancing power between Sunni and Shia power. And Chris, I think the cost of admission for the United States moving towards that role was frankly getting the Iran nuclear question off the table, because we couldn't disentangle from the old structure while that still existed. That's my answer in my heart of hearts. I can't marshal any documents or testimony to support it, though.
And assuming that's the case, for many of us, what that leads to is the great concern then that you'll have further nuclearization with the Saudis and others wishing to counter what they see as an inevitable path to the same for Iran, which, you know, gives us all significant pause. So I'll be quiet now. Many other people wish to ask questions. Thank you, sir, and also to our questioner, the professor. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Chris. All right, Sadine, who's up next?
We've got three questions pending still, so let's check in with another caller.
Thank you, General, for your service. As a former Air Force veteran myself, this is Gary Wheaton up in New Hampshire again. I was going to ask you about encryption and how that was affecting our challenges here, but I like the last questioner's line, and I want to take it a step further if I could.
Sure.
The thing I see different with Iran getting nuclear weapons, you know, versus, let's say, Korea or Pakistan even, is that if you look at the nature of the religion, what concerns me is martyrdom or suicidal. I don't know that North Korea is suicidal. Back in the Cold War days, we had mutually assured destruction. And now what do we have? As you indicated earlier, it's almost a guarantee that Iran is going to get nuclear. So where is that? You know, how do we discourage them from first strike, for example, and you know, bring Israel into the picture, if you will, too? I can't see them letting that happen, but if you can address that, that'd be great. Thanks.
Sure. So Gary, a couple of quick thoughts. Let me say something that you might find surprising. All right. I think if you ask my analysts out at the agency privately, certainly while I was there, they would tell you that these guys aren't going to cook off a nuclear weapon in the desert. The North Koreans needed to demonstrate that they had a weapon, so they've done that. All right. The Iranians, our view was that the Iranians wanted to park themselves within shouting distance of a nuclear device, but not, you know, put in the last screws and certainly not detonate a weapon to demonstrate that they could do it. They wanted to be in this magnificent position of nuclear ambiguity where clearly they could imply in any future crisis, hey, you guys need to be careful with us. I got a lot of stuff in the garage here that I could put together. I mean, our view was they could get 80 to 90% of what they needed from a quote-unquote nuclear capacity by parking very close to a weapon. So what gives me real gas, Gary, about the deal is they get to park right next to the capacity for a nuclear weapon. So that's one thought I'd share with you. This can be bad even if they never put the thing together. The other one you suggest, and I would not blame this on religion. I would simply say that this is, unlike North Korea or Pakistan, a messianic regime. And it is that messianic regime characteristic that gives me pause and makes me perhaps more frightened about them, although I can get pretty scared about Kim Jong-un, too. I will add one final thought, though, Gary. My analysts at CIA would tell me, for all their rhetoric and for all the kind of the messianic underpinnings of the regime, when it came down to what you and I call brass tacks, these guys were incredibly coldly calculating about whether or not they did or did not have a winning hand. And so I don't know how much that might temper your concern and mine about the messianic nature of the regime, but the historical record has been when someone's pushed back, and that is an important precondition, Gary, when someone has pushed back, these guys respond in a pretty rational way.
And I've seen that as well, obviously, after the Iraq War, they did back off a little bit. But my concern is still there for sure.
Okay.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
Once again, we're speaking with General Hayden. He's the author of the best-selling book, Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. Jamil, should we take another call?
That'd be great.
Here we go.
Yes, this is Jim Haynes. I'm a member of the Federalist Society, and I wanted to thank General Hayden. And
hey, Jim, good to hear from you.
It's good to be heard from. I'm putting on a different hat, and that is of a recently retired federal employee. I've been out about 3 months, and I am one of the 22 million plus federal employees who had all of my records hacked out of the Office of Personnel Management. And my question really was, how much confidence should ordinary Americans have in the ability of our government to keep records secure? And also, just to follow up, kind of a blank slate in front of General Hayden, what advice or counsel would you give those of us who are not really specialists in the matters that you've been talking about, but who are all obviously affected? And I would leave it there and give you a chance to answer.
Okay, Jim, thanks. Thanks very much. Well, you know, wow. The OPM attack, I firmly believe that it was done by the Chinese. For policy reasons, our government has preferred not to specifically identify it, although Jim Clapper, the DNI, let that slip out informally at one public gathering. I think our government doesn't want to say it because once they've said it, the follow-on question is, so what are you going to do about it? So they kind of leave this last thin thread of ambiguity hanging out there. You know, when you look at recent events, Jim, our government hasn't shown itself to be real competent keeping secrets. You got the OPM hack. Frankly, the whole Snowden affair is another failure of our government being unable to keep legitimate secrets secret. And so if I'm a policymaker, I'm probably more than a little unhappy with the permanent government's performance with doing the kinds of things you and I should expect them to do. And so I guess you're getting a certain air of disappointment out of me and maybe a certain lack of confidence in the ability of our government to protect the information they demand from you and me. On the OPM hack, I've publicly said, Jim, that is traditional state espionage, and if I could have done the same thing against the Chinese when I was director of NSA, I'd have done it in a heartbeat. And here's the punchline, Jim. I would not have had to ask special permission. It's what governments do. It's an R-rated movie out there. This is what adult states do to one another. And so I firmly emphasize that the OPM theft of your records and mine, all right, is no shame on China. That is absolutely shame on us for allowing that sort of thing to happen.
Well, I tried to provoke a chuckle when I was being processed out of the government by suggesting that the retirement counselors simply call a number in Shanghai, where my records were probably better maintained than they were at OPM. But that would be my commentary.
No, and you know what? You know what, Jim? People have asked me, so what are you going to do with this? And frankly, that is going to inform Chinese espionage until all 22 million of us die off. I mean, the kinds of information you need to target, to exploit, to coerce individuals into cooperation or to intercept their communications, they're all there laid out for Chinese espionage services to see.
Absolutely.
And so I don't know that we're going to fall off a cliff here because of the OPM theft, but I do see a serious advantage to the Chinese that will last probably for the next 30 years.
We've got just 5 minutes left, a couple questions pending. Jamil, should we carry on?
Let's do it.
Here we go.
Hi, this is Nafisa Saeed from Bloomberg in Washington. I had a quick question just building off of your last statement on the alleged leak last week from the shadow brokers of alleged toolkit from NSA. I wanted to see what your thoughts were on that, maybe who's behind it. Does it look like something that came from NSA? And is it a continuation of what you're saying in terms of what you called incompetency of keeping secrets? And what risks are there now that that information is out there?
So a couple of things, and let me preface this very clearly with, I know nothing. I have not asked. No one has offered me information. What I know is what I've read in the paper. So I have to begin all my comments with the caveat, if this is in any way true, comma, all right? So beginning with that, if this is in any way true, this is a serious matter. Now, it again, probably not going over the edge of the cliff, like I said for the last questioner with regard to OPM, because it appears that the tools that have been made public or that this group has were a bit dated. And boy, let me tell you, tools in the cyber domain date themselves really, really quickly. And so in terms of raw capacity, you perhaps not a great that great a loss. We'll see. Again, I don't have the fine print. I don't have the details. In terms, however, of suggesting, well, let me turn that around. How did that happen? All right. What was the unforced error? What was the foot fault that created the opportunity for someone like that to get a grip on these kinds of tools? And that is a very, very serious question. You know, that keeping the secrets is a responsibility of agencies like NSA. And let me develop that just one more turn. It's just not keeping your operational secrets so that your operational stuff is still effective. If you're going to collect information, right, that you know, under any definition of the word, will affect the privacy of targeted individuals, the targeted individuals should expect that nothing happens to that information other than what you intended to have happen for that information. And if you can't protect it, if it is suddenly made public, that calls into question your legitimacy in collecting it in the first place. And so this is a serious matter on multiple levels.
We've got a couple minutes left to try and squeeze in this last call. Should we take it, Jamil?
Let's do it. 2 minutes left.
I'll ask the caller to be as succinct as possible. Go ahead, caller.
Joseph, too.
Okay, go ahead. This is more of a policy. Yeah, policy question. I come from AT&T, as well as their cleared NSA group and everything like that. And I spent the last 20 years working for various telecommunications companies. Everything from the CIA group, the Shadow Crew investigation with TCF Bank. So basically my question here is, recently the CEO, Randall Stephenson of AT&T, has come out publicly saying that, you know, are providing authorization and access to AT&T customer data. It was absolutely wrong and this and that. And then going beyond that, obviously with these state hacks, all you hear is, you know, NSA, you know, it's coming from China or it's coming from Russia, where there's a lot of other actors. For instance, the LexisNexis hack was also coming, we believe, out of Russia, but that affected even the president, Michelle Obama, and everybody else, where somebody basically sent malware to a low-ranking individual within probably their marketing department, and hackers from Russia had unauthorized access to everybody's Social Security information, their credit history, everything like that. So, you know, what's going on, I guess, you know, back from the 1990s, the NSA said, hey, we're doing all these audits on all these government systems, and we're providing OPM reports saying that our security is atrocious. And, you know, fast forward nearly, a decade later, and we're still suffering the same problems. I mean, what is there any solution?
Well, I mean, given your background, I think you know probably better than I that the solution's tough just because of the very nature of the cyber domain. I mean, we architected it in a way that was designed for speed, convenience, and scale, and then someone said, what about security? And, oh, yeah, we'll get to that. And so we are in a perpetual tail chase here with security, trying to catch up to all these other attributes, which you and I and everyone else has embraced as all the reasons we put things we used to keep in a safe or a drawer or at least in our office, and now put it up here in this cyber domain construct. So number one, it's hard. Number two, it's really hard for governments, and particularly our government, to keep up just because of the pace. Look, I wanted to do something simple at NSA, like upgrade my IT, all right, just make it better. And I found I could not do that on the government budgeting system. I had to outsource my IT to a private contractor who could make the massive upfront investments and then amortize them over the life of the company.
Well, who is that? Who is that outsourced vendor? Is that like one of my interns that previously worked for Northrop Grumman, who is also of Indian descent, who believes in that country and everything? That could potentially present a threat to, you know, Homeland Security.
Well, aren't we now showing how complicated the problem is? Because when you outsource to industry because they're more agile than the government, and that is almost a state of nature, you do buy into the broader industry culture, which is globalized. I get it. But back to my point, this is really hard. The final point I'll make is that it might be really hard for our government to do this, not just any government, but our government, simply because you and I are very concerned about personal privacy and Fourth Amendment kinds of things. And so we aren't quite sure what it is we want or what it is we'll let this government do to keep your data and my data safe, because we're Americans. We fear government power. So I'm afraid this issue is going to be with us for a long time. Now, all that said, we should demand better performance from the government than we have seen to date. Witness the OPM hack and the other loss of information the government has taken from us, with certainly at least the implicit promise that they can protect it. Otherwise, they don't have the right to take it.
Jamil, we are out of questions. Let me thank you both, Jamil Jaffer and General Hayden, for the last time, the best-selling author of Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. I should mention that the link to the book was provided to you in the notice of today's call. But genuine thanks to both of you. This is fascinating, and it's a fascinating book as well. Thanks to the audience as well for joining us and for your questions. We certainly appreciate it. A reminder to our audience that our next scheduled teleform call will be tomorrow at 3 p.m. We'll be discussing religious freedom at religious colleges. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.